good evening. In the news tonight, a delegation of U.S. senators meet with the new prime minister of Afghanistan as U.S. bombs continue to rain down on parts of that country. Microsoft suffers another setback in its effort to delay its federal antitrust trial. And in New York, a federal court overturns the convictions of two black men convicted for their alleged roles in the 1991 Crown Heights riot, while a Muslim congregation in New Jersey files discrimination charges against a local hotel. With these and other stories, I'm Jose Santiago in New York, and this is the news for Monday, January 7, 2002. First, we go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
U.S. warplanes shelled a large Taliban and Al-Qaeda weapons reserve today in Afghanistan. The Pentagon says U.S. forces are trying to dismantle remaining suspected terrorist networks in the region. Pentagon spokesperson Rear Admiral John Stufflebeam.
What you've seen is a work in progress. The job is not complete.
Stufflebeam also says the U.S. has 346 Taliban and Al-Qaeda members in custody. However, the Pentagon will not say how many of the prisoners are suspected terrorist leaders. The Supreme Court today rejected an appeal from Oklahoma City bombing defendant Terry Nichols. The high court refused to block a trial that could bring Nichols a death sentence. At issue is the state of Oklahoma's plans to try Nichols on several charges, including 160 counts of first-degree murder. But Nichols' defense argued that another trial would be double jeopardy. Nichols is currently serving a life sentence for his role in the bombing of the Alfred T. Murrah Federal Building. The 1995 bombing killed 168 people and left over 500 injured. A Palestinian ship captain today accused the Palestinian Authority of arms smuggling. Israeli commandos stormed Captain Omar Akawi's ship last week and seized close to 50 tons of weapons. Akawi says the shipment was ordered by a Palestinian Authority official. However, the Palestinian Authority has denied the charge. An African-American activist formerly known as H-Rap Brown will lose some of his privileges behind bars. A judge ruled that Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin violated a gag order in his murder case. The Georgia judge says Al-Amin attempted to taint a jury pool by writing letters from jail and giving an interview to the New York Times. Last week, the former Black Panther also gave an interview to Washington's Pacifica sister station, WPFW-FM. The judge stripped Al-Amin's phone privileges and has limited his amount of visitors. Al-Amin is jailed behind the shooting death of a sheriff's deputy almost 2 years ago. But the former 60s radical maintains that he's innocent. For the Pacifica Network News in Washington, I'm Russell Green.
Published reports indicate much of Afghanistan is returning to a level of lawlessness not seen since the early 1990s. The New York Times reported that in some parts of the country, warlords are actually taking the food aid intended for the Afghani people. Late last week, the Karzai government and the leader of the international peacekeeping contingent agreed on the terms for the future deployment of as many as 4,500 peacekeepers from 17 different nations. Pacifica Network News National Affairs correspondent Bob Hennelly has more.
At first, President Bush's military campaign in Afghanistan appeared to be going better than anyone had expected. But that momentum appears to have stalled, just as the U.S. suffered its second combat casualty late last week. In the last few weeks, the inability to locate Osama bin Laden and Taliban leader Mullah Mohammed Omar is part of a much broader U.S. frustration expressed by Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Stufflebeam.
There have been many instances where they've just evaporated, changed sides, and I think this is just another example that we're seeing the same thing. It's a culture within this area, and so if there are those who are Afghan nationals and they work it out with other Afghan nationals to their satisfaction, to the constitutional government, provisional government's satisfaction, then we'll respect that.
Over the last few weeks, U.S. military planners have largely held their fire, waiting for the outcome of supposed surrender talks involving anti-Taliban military commanders and emissaries from Mullah Omar, only to hear things were never clear on what would happen, and also to find out there was never any intention of handing over Omar. General Tommy Franks, commander of U.S. Central Command.
I think that we accurately characterize our thoughts on Omar as saying we really don't know where he is. I mean, if we absolutely knew where Omar was, then we probably would be taking pretty direct action. And so we have received, and I think we've said, that we've received indications that he may be in the area of northern Helmand province, north of Kandahar, and that certainly is the area of Bagram. Terrencoat, Deir Rawood, and so we're interested in activities in that area.
After weeks of U.S. air assaults in the mountainous Tora Bora region, an undetermined number of al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters appear to have escaped Afghanistan by crossing over into Pakistan, where it's easy to blend in with the population. Admiral Stufflebeam.
What we really do believe has occurred is that they have disbanded into smaller groups. It would be, I think, obvious that some have probably gone over the mountain into Pakistan. But we also believe that there, some of these small groups are still within Afghanistan and may, in fact, be trying to get back together. Evidence of that recently we saw with those strikes around the Gardez area. So we believe that those dangerous groups are still in Afghanistan. There are probably some that have gone to Pakistan.
U.S. military have observed that some Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters have bribed their way out of captivity, and the overwhelming bulk of the Taliban army forces have returned to their homes, often still armed. On NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, interim Afghanistani leader Hamid Karzai described the situation of repatriating members of the Taliban.
The common Taliban are just common people. They've all gone back to their homes and they're with their families. What was important was this hardcore of the radical terrorist elements who were within the Taliban and within the terrorists. Those were the people that were leading this this force, that were leading this carnage. They should be arrested. Some of them are arrested. We are looking for the rest of them too. They were not responsible for anything. They were just common soldiers. We are actually looking at a smaller number of hardcore Taliban and terrorist elements that may not number more than 30 or 35.
Some 6,000 to 7,000 Taliban members have been captured, with as many as 3,500 being held in one jail in substandard conditions. U.S. interrogation teams have been working their way through the ranks of these prisoners. Currently, 340 have been transferred over into U.S. custody. But this most recent phase of the U.S. campaign appears to be filled with much greater peril for U.S. military personnel. On the Sunday talk show circuit, Senator Bob Graham of Florida, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, talked about the changing nature of the effort.
We're in a new phase of this war, and that phase is going to be greater personal exposure. For one thing, the lines aren't easily drawn. A few weeks ago, when the Northern Alliance was fighting with the Taliban, there was a clear indication of who your allies, who your enemies were. Today, we're dealing with groups of people who represent a mixture of former allies and enemies, and obviously one of those enemies took this as an opportunity to take out his vengeance against a United States military.
Within Afghanistan, continued USA bombing has been a political headache for the new Karzai government, because persistent reports of civilian casualties have caused local elders to petition Karzai to ask the U.S. to stop. Over the last few weeks, the number of bombing runs has dropped off significantly as the U.S. runs out of targets. For months, reporters at Pentagon briefings didn't directly ask Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld about the potential toll on the civilian population from the bombing. But as anecdotal reports of inexact hits mounted, Rumsfeld fielded the question this way.
There's never been a conflict where there have not been civilian deaths. If one were to take this activity in Afghanistan and rank it as to the number of civilian deaths and the care and attentiveness that has gone in to try to have the right weapon and the most precise method of doing things, I can't imagine there's been a conflict in history where there has been less collateral damage.
The London Times reports that the U.S. war in Afghanistan could end up costing twice as many civilian lives as did the 78-day NATO air war campaign against Yugoslavia. Even though with conditions on the ground still so chaotic, confirmation of civilian death tolls remained highly speculative. Bob Henley, Pacifica Network News.
As the U.S. military operations meet with success in Afghanistan, the Bush administration is looking elsewhere in the war on terrorism, and the Afghan model, as it's being called, could be turned against Iraq. Retired General Wayne Downing is now White House counterterrorism chief. 3 years ago, he drew up a plan to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, similar to the Afghan model. Michael Clare is professor for the Peace and Security World Studies at Hampshire College. He spoke with Pacifica Network News senior correspondent Don Rush.
What do you see as the next stage in this war on terrorism? Well, you know, the president has always said that Afghanistan is just the beginning, and we know that the U.S. has been looking at other sites for possible military action. They would include the Philippines, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and especially Iraq. There's a lot of talk in Washington of beginning a new Persian Gulf war to topple Saddam Hussein, and there's a lot of momentum in that direction.
Well, in terms of Iraq, how much momentum do you think there is? And there was a recent piece outlining the idea that one could use the Afghan model as a way to prosecute a war in Iraq.
We know that the Deputy Secretary of Defense, that is Paul Wolfowitz, has been an ardent advocate of starting a war against Saddam Hussein, and that there's much support for that within the administration. So it's clear that a lot of preparation has been made. We don't know whether the president himself has made a decision, has given a green light to that, but certainly it's clear that the administration has approved preparatory actions. For example, the president has called for filling up the National Strategic Petroleum Reserve. This is an emergency reservoir of oil in the case of war. It's never been filled up before, and now it's being filled, and that suggests to me planning for a war in the Middle East.
Does the Afghan model work, though, in the Iraqi situation?
I don't see how it could really work in Iraq. In Afghanistan, you had a relatively weak army, the army of the Taliban movement, and you had fairly well-equipped Northern Alliance troops that actually controlled territory where they could be rearmed. There's no equivalent in Iraq. The Iraqi army itself has 300,000 or 400,000 soldiers and a lot of heavy equipment. The opposition forces are very weak, don't really control any territory. So any attack against Iraq would have to be conducted primarily with American troops. It would have to be an American war, and presumably something on the scale of Operation Desert Storm.
Do you see anyone in the administration who would put a real drag on any movement toward utilizing this model and carrying out such a war against Iraq?
Probably there's some opposition from the CIA, because they're the ones who would have to be informing the president that, look, we really can't pull this off, that the opposition forces in Iraq simply don't have the strength to take on the Iraqi government. And it's also evident that the State Department opposes this kind of move, because a U.S. war against Iraq would be almost entirely a unilateral move and would alienate allies of the United States that are needed for the war against terrorism. So I think you have some opposition within Washington for a move against Iraq.
There was a suggestion there might be help when there was this revolt in southern Iraq right after the Persian Gulf War. That, of course, did not come. Then there was the CIA operation with the Kurds in the north. The Kurds seemed to get left to Saddam Hussein's own devices. How much confidence can one have in terms of the administration actually going through this if you're an Iraqi in the south or if you're a Kurd in the north?
My guess is that those forces, the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north, would be very leery of any call by Washington to start a revolt against Saddam Hussein, because they'll be very frightened that the U.S. would abandon them again. So this is why I come to the conclusion that any effort to topple Saddam Hussein would have to rely on a heavy involvement by American forces, American ground forces, in addition to air power, of course.
Now, looking beyond Iraq, do you see the U.S. taking other military steps, or do you think this would be far more strategic in terms of going in and taking somebody, that kind of thing, rather than the Afghan model that we've been looking at?
It's early to be too definitive about what might happen. It's obvious that the U.S. is already working with the Philippines government in operations against Abu Sayyaf and other Islamic rebel forces in the southern Philippines. There we're providing advisory support, technical support. It wouldn't surprise me if U.S. involvement got deeper in the months ahead. Likewise, in Somalia, there's a real possibility of the U.S. getting involved. In this case, the U.S. could work with Ethiopia. Ethiopian forces have volunteered to go into Somalia to try to crush some of the pro-Al-Qaeda forces there. Of course, Ethiopia has had a long territorial dispute with Somalia, so they have interests of their own to pursue. But yes, the U.S. has been apparently meeting with Ethiopians to talk about that possibility.
Michael Clare is a professor for the Peace and Security World Studies at Hampshire College. He spoke with Pacifica Network News correspondent Don Rush. Today, President Bush conceded this year's federal budget will probably bleed red ink, but he blamed it on war, recession, and a national emergency. Democrats, on the other hand, point to the Bush administration's $1.3 trillion tax cut for eliminating what has been projected as budget surpluses in the near future. But there's another major player, unaccountable to the public, who critics say should bear part of the blame for the nation's economic woes. Pacifica Network News correspondent Laura Iyama has more on the criticism of Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan.
Today, President Bush said he will again ask Congress to pass his economic stimulus package.
A tax cut is part of the prescription for economic recovery.
Federal Reserve Board Chair Alan Greenspan was present but did not talk with reporters. But at a Washington meeting sponsored by Ralph Nader Center for Study of Responsive Law, Greenspan was front and center. The meeting featured critics of Greenspan and the role of the Federal Reserve, which some characterized as the fourth branch of government, for its impact on the U.S. economy and politics, yet most of its activities are shielded from public view. Jeff Faw of the Economic Policy Institute says Greenspan's actions are political, pointing to the Fed chair's advice to Democrats.
Convinced by Greenspan, they had spent the Clinton years, 8 years of their presidency, paying off Ronald Reagan's debts, sacrificing the needs of their own working people constituency on the altar of deficit reduction, only to wake up at the end of this 8 years completely snookered. It turned out it wasn't the deficit that Greenspan was after. It was their domestic agenda.
Foss says the surplus then went to Bush's constituency in the form of the $1.3 trillion tax cut. Greenspan is often portrayed as a major financial leader, credited with the economic boom of the 90s. But Tom Schlesinger, the executive director of a research group known as the Financial Market Center, spoke of Greenspan's paradoxes.
Here's a guy who called himself a libertarian in public and who pushed very aggressively and effectively for decontrol and desupervision of financial enterprise across the board, domestically and globally, and who was, on the other hand, the single greatest dispenser of emergency liquidity in Federal Reserve history, also true on a domestic and global basis. And this goes back to the chairman's efforts during the early 1990s when the banking sector was reeling and the Fed provided discount window liquidity as it never had before and certainly hasn't since.
Schlesinger also said Greenspan and the Federal Reserve are more concerned with helping the markets than the poor.
Radically underestimated the significance of an explosion and the implications of that explosion in subprime credit. Gets back to the point I made earlier about the growth in household debt. The people who are feeling the impact of this recession first and worst are in many cases subprime borrowers who have always been most vulnerable to unemployment and income shrinkage.
Yet, when it came time to help financial institutions in the early 90s, for example, with the collapse of the Mexican peso, the Federal Reserve stepped forward to offer funds when Congress would not. University of Texas professor Robert Auerbach points to notes posted now on the Fed's own website indicating Fed officials realized this action may be beyond their legal boundaries.
You'll see that they were very frightened about doing this. What is the collateral? We're going to give $5 billion to Mexico. They could really hang us if they find out about this. But they did it. And that's not the first time that they'd lent money to foreign countries bypassing Congress.
Other Fed policies also came under criticism, such as keeping interest rates up to tamp down wages to keep inflation in check. Journalist William Grider says that a new economic model needs to be considered.
Labor people will say the idea of a wage run-up that produces a soaring inflation is absurd in a world where global competition is constantly suppressing wage growth. Cutback contracts because the auto workers in Mexico are making an eighth of what we make, or in Asia they're making even less, and so forth and so on.
University of Texas economist James Galbraith says there should be a commission to evaluate the Fed's performance.
As late as May of 2000, even after the crash of the technology bubble, it was still raising interest rates. Why? What for? To fight an inflation that never existed, that never would.
All the critics acknowledge it's unlikely that any review of the Federal Reserve will occur in the near future, since the institution plays a key role in the U.S. economy and the U.S. is at war. Still, they expressed hope that at some point, Congress will reform the Federal Reserve into a more democratic institution. Laura Iyama, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
Fallen energy giant Enron is under investigation by four congressional committees, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Departments of Justice and Labor, following a stunning collapse that led to the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Enron used a web of political connections last year to tilt the regulatory playing field to its advantage. This, according to a report by the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. Tyson Slocum is a policy analyst at Public Citizen, and he's author of its report on Enron. He spoke about the connections between politics and business at Enron.
What we found at Public Citizen was that Enron's entire business strategy was built around treating electricity as a speculative commodity. And Enron theorized that they could make more money speculating on the price of electricity than they could by actually producing it at a power plant. And central to that business concept of treating electricity as a speculative commodity was removing government oversight over its operations. Because, you know, speculation is not necessarily a positive thing in the American economy. And so as a result, government employs lots of regulations over speculative activities. Enron, using its influence in the Bush administration and in Congress, especially with Phil Graham, by giving millions of dollars in campaign contributions, pushed through legislation that completely removed government oversight over a significant portion of its operations, which allowed it to operate an unregulated power auction where it could manipulate the supplies of electricity, price gouge consumers, and make hundreds of millions of dollars in profits. What we need to do is to highlight the fact that the origins of deregulation were in political corruption. That was, Enron was giving millions of dollars to well-connected politicians in both the Bush administration and to members of Congress like Phil Graham to push through this agenda. And we really need to investigate these conflicts of interest. By far, the biggest violation of conflict of interest is Wendy and Phil Graham. Phil Graham is a Republican senator from Texas, and his wife, Wendy Graham, serves on Enron's board of directors, and as a board member at Enron, she also serves on their audit committee, where she is privy to financial details about the company's operations that aren't available to Wall Street analysts or to the general public. So the Grahams received between $915,000 and $1.8 million in cash compensation for Wendy Graham's services on Enron's board. And Phil Graham received almost $260,000 in campaign contributions from Enron. That was Enron's single largest recipient in Congress, and also Enron was Phil Graham's single largest source of corporate campaign contributions. So the political and the personal financial connections are there. And then when you look at what the Grahams did to benefit Enron, to remove government oversight of their operations, which allowed Enron to price gouge consumers in the Western electricity market, really need to be investigated.
Well, the other thing that really needs to be investigated is, as you say in your report, Wendy Graham resigns her position as chairwoman of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. She has provided Enron with an exemption from regulation that it wanted. 5 weeks later, Enron appoints her to its board of directors. I find it shocking, and I'm sure this speaks to my naivete, that there isn't some kind of a two-year limit between the time you resign a government position and then you can actually get a job with one of the corporations that you had been in charge of regulating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that kind of blatant conflict of interest seems to be very, very common with Phil and Wendy Graham. And, you know, Phil Graham is a close personal friend of Ken Lay, and he introduced legislation in 2000 that really complemented what his wife had done back in 1993, where she muscled through the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, you know, as you pointed out, some specific language that allowed Enron to engage in electricity trading in an unregulated way. And then Phil Graham, just days after the Supreme Court ruled in Bush's favor in the 2000 election fiasco, just 3 days after that Supreme Court decision, Phil Graham tacks onto a huge unrelated appropriations bill this language that specifically allowed Enron to operate an unregulated power auction. And, you know, none of the media was paying attention to this. And just weeks after Enron was allowed to operate this unregulated power auction because of Phil Graham, California was plunged into a month-long period of rolling blackouts. That's because Enron was able to manipulate supplies of electricity to such a degree that millions of California consumers were intentionally denied getting the electricity they needed.
Well, how likely is it that we'll actually see Phil Graham brought to testify in front of his colleagues in Congress?
I definitely foresee it at some point. I think what we're going to see first is his wife coming before the committee, because she's an Enron employee, and she was privy to these financial details. She met with Arthur Anderson, Enron's accounting firm. She met with Ken Lay. They all sat down at the table together and wrote out the financial statements that were presented to the shareholders.
Is there a connection, do you think, between Phil Graham deciding not to seek re-election and Enron's bankruptcy?
Oh, absolutely. The Grahams are involved very deeply in this. And you can draw a timeline from when Enron first started having financial problems in June of 2001. That's when the federal government, under enormous political and economic pressure, was forced to re-regulate the entire Western electricity market. And that re-regulation order severely limited the ability of Enron to continue manipulating supplies and prices, which also affected their bottom line. And you can draw a timeline from June of 2001 to today, and you can see top executives from Enron dropping like flies, like Jeff Skilling did. He resigned in August, less than a month after the re-regulation order. And then Phil Graham, a month after that, announces that he's not going to seek re-election. It was a very abrupt and a very curious press conference that Phil Graham did. And I think it's definitely because he and his wife are in very deep, and they knew that the Democrats would make it a major campaign issue.
Tyson Slocum is a policy analyst at Public Citizen and author of its report on Enron. And that's our report. We welcome your comments. You can reach us at pnn@pacifica.org. The engineers are Joe Gill, Andy York, and Roman Hunt. The headlines editor is Russell Green. The producer is Patricia Guadalupe. And I'm Josephine Reed for Pacifica Network News in Washington. Thanks for listening.
Pacifica Network News is also made possible by you, the listener, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the Pacifica family of stations. KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, KPFT in Houston, WBAI in New York, and WPFW in Washington. We'll be right back.
And good evening once again. I'm Jose Santiago in New York for the WBAI Evening News. In local news, a federal appeals court today overturned the convictions of two men in the 1991 fatal stabbing of a Jewish rabbinical student in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. It means that Lembrick Nelson and Charles Price will get a new trial. The appeals court found that efforts to create a racially balanced jury were flawed. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals said the trial judge made special efforts that were unconstitutional in an effort to secure an unbiased jury for the prosecution of Lembrick Nelson and Charles Price, two black men accused in the racially charged case. The appeals court ordered a new trial before a properly chosen jury, saying that the lower court ended up empaneling a juror who had showed actual bias when he answered questions from lawyers before the jury was chosen. The ruling came in a case stemming from the death of 7-year-old Gavin Cato, who was black. He was struck and killed by a Jewish driver, sparking days of street violence that included the fatal stabbing of rabbinical student Yankel Rosenbaum. Nelson, then 16 years old, was charged with killing Rosenbaum. A state jury acquitted him. In federal court, however, he was convicted of violating Rosenbaum's civil rights. He is serving 20 years in prison, along with Price, who was convicted for allegedly provoking rioters. A grand jury declined to charge the driver, Joseph Lifsch, who escaped to Israel, where he has never had to answer any charges in connection with the death of Gavin Cato and with the lifelong injuries received by Cato's sister. The driver was operating a car that was part of the entourage of cars that often accompanied Menachem Schneerson, the late Grand Rebbe of the Lubavitcher Hasidic group. In Teaneck, New Jersey, a local Muslim congregation has filed a discrimination lawsuit against the Glen Point Marriott Hotel. According to the group, the hotel has repeatedly refused to rent space to the congregation for prayer services. Attorney Hamdi Rifai represents the Darul Islam Muslim congregation in his discrimination lawsuit.
My client is an Islamic church, a masjid. And they have been trying to rent the ballroom at the Marriott Hotel since 1988, twice a year for their Eid prayers. And that usually takes place around 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, during that time period from 1988 till date, on each occasion they've been rejected for renting the ballroom, except once in 1994 and once in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. In the year 2000, when they were able to rent the ballroom, they were only able to do, the Marriott Hotel only agreed to do so after pressure was brought to bear upon them from the Attorney General's office here in New Jersey, as well as Assemblywoman Loretta Weinberg and some interfaith groups objected to the fact that they were not accommodating their needs. Only after that they agreed to rent it to them last year. This year when they tried to rent it to them again, they again said, no, you can't have it, and it's not the reason was because it wasn't available. Well, the president of the masjid, Mr. Wahid Khalid, went to the hotel at that time when they said it wasn't available, and it was completely dark. It was not being used for anything on either of the dates that he had requested.
Mm-hmm.
Which led him to believe that they were lying to him, and which confirmed his suspicions that they were discriminating against him. Well, not against him, but against the masjid for religious reasons,
mm-hmm.
which caused the filing of this complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Alfred Sanzari Enterprises, that's the other defendant in this case, they own a parking facility next to the Glen Point Marriott, and what the masjid does is when the hotel rejects them each time, they approach the parking facility and ask them to rent the parking facility to them, and then they set up tents in the parking lot of the masjid where people can walk from the parking facility to the masjid, because all of these people are neighbors to one another. They're only a block away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And this year the parking facility said, no, we don't want to do business with them, period. And that was as far as they would go. Even though the parking facilities were available, they refused to rent it to them.
Now this rental, is this for a one-time sort of event? Or
no, this is just for twice a year, for the Eid celebration, for the Eid prayers.
Have they made any comment as to why?
My client only wants an empty ballroom. They don't need any setup. They don't need anything. They leave it in the same condition that they rent it. Compared to a wedding or some other type of, you know, accommodation that they would make there, this is probably the least burden that could be placed upon the hotel and the space. You know, typically in weddings, they have dancing and food and alcohol and all this sort of thing, and people get a little bit rowdy. In this context, it's the exact opposite. People are coming there for the sole purpose of prayer, and so it's a very quiet ceremony that doesn't really disrupt anything. So they have not indicated any kind of reason like that they would not rent it. They tried to say last year that people removing their shoes to do the prayer was a violation of state regulation, and I know of no state regulation as an attorney that makes removing your shoes a violation. Frankly, if there was, it would be kind of silly interpretation of the law, I think. And it would certainly go against the Religious Accommodations Clause. And it would certainly go against the New Jersey law against discrimination under which we're suing.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are you seeking in terms of damages, if any, in this case?
Well, we're seeking the typical damages, which is consequential, punitive damages. We're seeking specific performance that they make accommodation of the masjid for future prayers. So those are the three primary things that we're requesting. Obviously, people are quite upset by it. I mean, the fact of the matter is that they're very, respectful people that do not cause any kind of ruckus or anything like that. And most people in the community resent the fact that they're being discriminated against based solely on their religion. Certainly, we as a society, our strength as Americans comes from tolerance, freedom of speech, these types of religious freedoms as well that we afford people. And I think the Marriott is going against everything that we as Americans stand for in this case. I think anybody looking at this would probably reach the same conclusion that, you know, the Marriott is not only betraying the Muslim community and their ideals, but our ideals as Americans as well. And I think most of the people that attend this congregation are United States citizens. You know, they pay their taxes, they vote on election day, they try to help their neighbors, and they want to be good members of their community, and their neighbor, the Marriott, doesn't seem to feel the same way. The hotel seems to have some sort of animus towards people of the Muslim faith.
Attorney Hamdi Rifai represents the Darul Islam Muslim congregation based in the Teaneck, New Jersey area. A spokesperson for the hotel denied any discrimination but would not comment beyond that. Calls left for the parking lot operator were not immediately returned. The two defendants have 35 days to respond to the charges. In other news, hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers could lose their health insurance as a special program put into effect after the attack on the World Trade Center comes to an end. The destruction of the World Trade Center disrupted the computer system supporting the Medicaid program in the city. Shortly after the attack, Governor George Pataki created a program called Disaster Relief Medicaid Family Health Plus. Under that program, city residents could apply for health care benefits under rules that eliminate much of the documentation usually required to establish eligibility. But the program was limited to 4 months of coverage, and when those 4 months are up, those who have received disaster relief Medicaid will have to apply all over again, but under the standard application procedures. Assemblymember Richard Gottfried, chair of the State Assembly's Health Committee, is asking Governor George Pataki to extend the program. Speaking with WBAI's Andrea Sears, Gottfried says if it isn't extended, the results could be a disaster.
200,000 or 300,000 people who got health coverage through the disaster relief program are going to have the rug pulled out from under them and lose that coverage starting at the end of January unless Governor Pataki acts immediately to extend the program and provide for a smooth transition from the disaster relief Medicaid to regular Medicaid and Family Health Plus for these folks. They're all legally eligible for permanent Medicaid and Family Health Plus coverage, but there's no way on earth that the paperwork can be done in time before they lose their disaster relief Medicaid coverage. So 200,000 or 300,000 people who have gotten health coverage under this terrific effort that the governor put together are going to have it yanked away soon after they start getting the coverage. It doesn't have to be that way. The governor has the power to extend the sign-up period, to extend the coverage period, and to make the simplification of the application process a permanent part of Medicaid and Child Health Plus and Family Health Plus.
What were the criteria for people to be eligible for the disaster relief Medicaid?
It's very simple. If you meet the income levels of either Medicaid or Family Health Plus, you simply go down to an application office, fill out a form that's less than a page. The only documentation you have to provide is a photo ID, and you get a Medicaid card either that same day or the next morning. It's an extraordinarily terrific program.
Why has there been no action on this to date, considering that this will expire at the end of January?
I think you'd have to ask the governor why something hasn't happened yet. We've been calling on him since for over a month now to act on this. All sorts of advocacy groups have been calling for action. I'm hoping that on Wednesday in the State of the State message, he may announce something. But so far, there's been no indication of that.
What would it cost the state to extend this Medicaid coverage?
Well, Medicaid costs about $1,500, $2,000 a person per year. Half of that is paid by the federal government, one quarter by New York State, one quarter by New York City for city residents or other counties around the state. So for every person who enrolls in Medicaid, it costs the state about $400 or $500 a year. So if 1,000 more people are on Medicaid, it's $400,000 or $500,000. The cost is not all that major in terms of the overall state budget. It's enormously important to the individuals involved, and we're talking about health coverage that these folks and about a million other New Yorkers are today legally entitled to. They haven't been getting it because of the paperwork obstacles. It's as if a lot of children weren't enrolled in elementary school because of bureaucratic reasons. Nobody would tolerate that, and yet we tolerate people not getting the health coverage that they are legally entitled to.
And what is the cost of not extending Medicaid coverage in terms of uninsured people having to use the hospital or emergency rooms as primary health care facilities?
Well, we pay a pretty stiff price for that. When they go to the hospital, when their illness gets bad enough that they go to the hospital, our hospitals generally treat them as what is called uncompensated care. There is some state funding to hospitals for uncompensated care. Hospitals fund a lot of it by shifting costs to paying patients, to health insurance plans. So businesses that provide health coverage to their workers are bearing some of the burden for workers whose employers don't provide health coverage. Ultimately, society pays a hefty cost for the uninsured. And, of course, the uninsured pay the heaviest cost in bad health outcomes, lost work time, et cetera.
So what would it take for the governor to extend the disaster relief Medicaid? Is it something he can do on his own, or does it require legislative action?
He can do it administratively he needs federal approval because the program was created by administrative action by the governor with a federal waiver of some federal rules. The legislature did not create it, and so it could be extended in the same process. In fact, if the legislature were going to try to extend it, we would first have to legislatively create it before we could extend it. So the, basically, it is within, it's in the governor's hands to extend this program. He alone has the power to take the administrative actions to extend it, and he alone has the power to go to President Bush and get his approval.
So what will be the consequences if no action is taken? How many people will be affected? What will be the effect?
Well, 200,000 or 300,000 people who will be signed up for disaster relief Medicaid and who are getting health care as a result are going to lose the coverage and lose the health care. The first tens of thousands will fall off the rolls at the end of January and more every month after that. And hundreds of thousands of people who have now had the benefit of proper health care, in many cases life-extending and life-saving health care, are going to lose that health coverage. And many of them will get sicker. Many of them will die. Hospitals and health clinics will lose money providing them with health care, and that will further destabilize the health care system. All of the problems that we all know that come with people being uninsured will be thrown back at these couple of hundred thousand New Yorkers when they lose this coverage.
Assembly member Richard Gottfried is chair of the New York State Assembly's Health Committee. He was interviewed by WBAI's Andrea Sears. Representatives of several organizations, including the Legal Aid Society, the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and the United Hospital Fund, joined Gottfried at a news conference this morning calling for Governor Pataki to extend disaster relief Medicaid. And you are listening to the WBAI Evening News. I'm Jose Santiago in New York. In other news, after a five-month hiatus, Pacifica's Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman, returned to some of the Pacifica Network's five radio stations today. The hour-long radio magazine was removed from Pacifica by its producers after a long battle concerning staff and programming changes at this radio station, WBAI. Over the past several weeks, an agreement was reached to head off several lawsuits aimed at WBAI's parent organization, the Pacifica Foundation. At the heart of the lawsuits was the stated goal of ensuring the independence of local stations so they could operate free from restrictions imposed at the national level. Under the terms of the agreement, a new interim national board was formed to serve for 15 months with a mandate to democratize Pacifica and to reestablish the foundation's mission. That interim national board is headed by Leslie Kagan, who was among the guests on today's edition of Democracy Now!, which WBAI did not carry live. WBAI's Paul DiRienzo has prepared this report on the Democracy Now! Program and the broader issue of bringing democracy to Pacifica and to you, the listeners.
Let's take a listen to what WBAI is playing right now.
I'm sure it's us.
It is our system of law, our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all of that.
That's not my voice. What's going on here?
Film and TV producer Michael Moore expressing surprise at hearing the sound of WBAI producer Clayton Riley speaking instead of hearing Democracy Now! Goodman's program originates in New York City at the studios of Downtown Community Television, produced for 5 months under the title of Democracy Now! In Exile. Bob Daughtry has been general manager of WBAI for the past 3 months. Daughtry says he had planned to run Democracy Now! Later in the day, but when he heard the program, he decided its producers had strayed much too far from their mandate.
Well, it was not scheduled to be broadcast on WBAI this morning. I had been informed on Friday that Democracy Now! Would be airing on the satellite at 9 a.m. this morning. We had programming already scheduled, which we were reluctant to change the scheduling for regarding this morning. However, we did tape Democracy Now! And we were going to air it later in the day. After hearing the program, I don't think the program was about what it purports to be about. It's, they say Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. But at least half of the program was basically an attack on WBAI, an attack on Pacifica as far as this recent settlement is concerned, and as far as just airing the issues and grievances of the so-called banned and fired.
Daughtry also says he's concerned by the apparent radical changes in the way Pacifica has run its stations for the past 50 years. According to Pacifica's bylaws, says Daughtry, the chair of the National Board has no direct power over programming, hiring, and firing, or other day-to-day decisions made at each local station. But Board Chair Leslie Kagan made it clear on Monday's Democracy Now! That she sees the board as playing a major role in programming and other local station decisions, despite Kagan's acknowledgement that Pacifica is facing an almost insurmountable fiscal crisis.
We also, though, have a whole host of other tasks, including really doing an evaluation of the programming at all five stations. And how is the programming meeting the mission, or how is it not? And how do we begin to get the programming back on track to bring the voices onto the airwaves that Pacifica needs to be broadcasting?
Daughtry says Kagan's position is drastic and unsupported by the terms of the settlement agreement.
It's never happened before. The board of directors has never been involved in making programming decisions for the Pacifica stations. It's absolutely unprecedented. Certainly the board should be involved in oversight and should be concerned about the overall direction of the organization and what that means programmatically as well as with respect to other operations. But it's absolutely unprecedented that board members or a chairman in this case has said, you will play this program, you will play it at this time to the five stations.
WBAI General Manager Bob Daughtry isn't the only staffer with an opinion on the matter. After discovering Democracy Now! Is not being aired at WBAI, a phone call was put through to WBAI Public Affairs Director Javelle Fay, who responded to guest Michael Moore. Fay says it's not enough for Kagan to send a memo. That notice of an order to carry a program must come from Interim National Director Joanne Meredith, the person empowered by Pacifica bylaws to supervise local station managers.
Hello.
Oh, this is Javelle.
Hi, Javelle.
Yeah,
hey, it's Michael Moore.
Yeah, how you doing, man?
Hey, good, good. Hey, I'm on this show, Democracy Now!.
Yeah.
And, like, people aren't able to pick it up in New York on WBAI, and it's supposed to be on. This is the first morning it's back on Pacifica, and it's, like, a great day, and people can't get it.
Who told you that it's supposed to be on?
Well, there was, like, I read about this board meeting or something. The Pacifica board ordered it on to all the stations.
There has not been one single written paper from Pacifica that would urge us to play it.
They didn't get the memo then, right?
No.
Can I get a fax number right now from you? And I think these guys. You got the memo here, Leslie?
No. We got a memo from Leslie Kagan, but we're waiting for something from Pacifica, not from Leslie Kagan.
Well, she's the president of the board.
Well, maybe she should order Pacifica to send us a memo if she's the president of the board. You're telling me Leslie Kagan wrote a memo. I'm saying that memo is not enough for us to put it on the air. Now, Leslie has a right to go to the executive director and say, okay, do something about this thing. How about that?
Right.
Well,
if I could jump in for a second.
Hi, this is Leslie Kagan.
Yeah.
Kagan explains what she sees as a procedure for demanding that Democracy Now! Be carried.
My understanding is that the acting executive director of the Pacifica Foundation did contact each of the station managers to also make sure that they knew that the national board, the interim board, had met and had discussed this. So, in fact, communication went both from the national executive director and from the national board. That should have been enough. I don't think, in fact, we need to go around and around at this point on this show. The decision of the board was very, very clear, and it was communicated through several different vehicles.
WBAI General Manager Bob Daughtry tells his side.
I received a memo from Leslie Kagan that was under my door Friday that came late Thursday evening. The memo stated that Democracy Now! Would be back up on the satellite at 9 a.m. on Monday morning, and so I was apprised of that. I had to make certain assumptions based on the memo because it didn't, all of the processes that would normally be involved in either returning a show or putting a new show on were not outlined in that memo. And I guess in part that's because the board members don't have any actual experience in running radio stations.
One of the central issues of the Pacifica dispute is what the former dissidents, now in the majority, call the return of Pacifica to its original mission, a position often criticized as vague. Another hot issue is often called democratization. Droshi says he's committed to opening the stations to more listener input.
We're all interested in democratization, so democratizing Pacifica as a phrase doesn't scare me. And the whole point of the IPNB, the Interim Pacifica National Board, is to come up with new bylaws and policies as long as it can get the two-thirds vote or the balanced majority votes that are required in this recently agreed-upon settlement. The whole point, then, is to look at the existing structure and see how they may further democratize that structure and hopefully make the organization not only more accessible to people, but also bring in more listeners and make it work in a more efficient fashion.
Former interim program director Bernard White was also a guest on Democracy Now! Monday morning. He's a leading member of the group calling themselves the Fired and Banned. White says it's only a matter of time before WBAI is returned to how the station sounded before December of last year, when then-station manager Valerie Van Isler and her hardcore supporters were fired by Pacifica National Director Bessie Wash.
They're moving as if there has been no settlement, that they have not been told that they are to play Democracy Now. I don't know exactly where this is going to go, but I do agree with Juan. It's one of these pockets of resistance that will eventually be reversed. They will be taking Democracy Now. The Fired and Banned will eventually be returned to WBAI.
Daughtry says the Fired and Banned issue happened before his watch, but referring to those programmers he has suspended, Daughtry says they can eventually come back.
What we want is good radio. And what does that mean? That means that our listeners and our listener supporters are well served from the programs that are done. And who are our listener supporters? Well, they made themselves very known in the last pledge drive that just ended in November. We raised $1 million. We're very proud of that. And our mission, our goal, is to continue to bring the kind of programmatic fare to those listeners, blacks, Latinos, and whites, who have supported WBAI not only in this recent drive, but over the years. We want to, that seems to be a growing audience, and we want to continue to grow that audience.
Let me ask you one last question. Here's a tough one. Do you expect to be here a year from now, 15 months from now, when this board is over?
That is a tough question. I hope if I am here a year from now that it will, in looking back, we will realize that the settlement was an instrument and a point of departure for a new and invigorated Pacifica, and not a point at which a grudge and revenge became the focal point for an organization that is in even deeper trouble at that point.
Bob Daughtry is general manager of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City. The Pacifica National Board is meeting in New York City on January 11th, 12th, and 13th. A session open to public comment is scheduled for Friday, January 11th at 6 p.m. The location of the meeting has not been determined. WBAI listeners are urged to attend. Tune in to WBAI's morning program, starting with Marjorie Moore weekdays at 6 a.m. for updates on the meeting's location. You can also call 212-209-2800 during the day for more information, or go to www.pacifica.org. For WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
In other news, a prominent Harlem and national clergy member who was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s closest aides during the 1950s and 60s civil rights struggles in the South is being treated for a mild stroke. 73-year-old Reverend Wyatt T. Walker was in stable condition after becoming ill during a lecture appearance in White Plains. The Reverend Jesse Jackson said that Walker suffered two mild strokes but is conscious and talking. Walker shared a jail cell with King after their arrest in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963 and helped organize Dr. King's March on Washington. And finally tonight, the Florida teenager who died after piloting a small airplane into a building has been described as a sweet and intelligent boy. Florida police say they found a note in the young man's pocket expressing support for Osama bin Laden. For commentator John Hess, the episode has a familiar ring.
We all asked the same question after Columbine. What could lead a middle-class American boy to do such a thing? The first answer was that at that age, many youngsters go a little mad, like a buck deer in springtime. It's true, but blaming hormones can only go so far. Grown-up America plies children with toy guns, babysits them with violence on the screen.